We turn now to four of the last five steps or stages or rungs in the spiritual ladder of St. John Climacus, chapters concerned with discernment, diakrisis, with the virtue of inward stillness or tranquility, hezukia, with prayer, and then finally with a sense of the interrelationship between the virtues and the conclusion of this text. His understanding of discernment, as you see in number 26.1, is distinguished according to the degree of spiritual progress that an individual has made. Diakrisis, or discernment, he says, in those who are beginning, is knowledge of one's self. The first place to begin is in true knowledge of what one is and what one is struggling with within. The second stage, he says, it is a sense that distinguishes what is truly good from what is of nature and what is opposed to it. So it's an ability to make distinctions between that which is truly good and that which is natural and those things that are opposed to the good and to the natural. And then finally, in the perfect, he says, it is a knowledge which is a capacity to enlighten what is dark in others. This is rather like Evagrius's notion of progress from being an ascetic, a practikos, to a gnostikos, to one who teaches and interprets. For St. John Climacus, there is a true diakrisis, or discernment, which is not only about one's own self, but a capacity to perceive what is needed in others. In other words, the ability to be a spiritual guide or a spiritual director. And then he offers another alternative definition. Discernment is an assured understanding of the divine will on all occasions, in every place, and in all matters. And the prerequisites, he says, are purity of heart and purity of body and purity of mouth, that is to say, purity of speech. So here we have a notion of a discernment or a distinction or an understanding of a perception of God's presence within the self, within the world around us, and then the capacity to use that gift on behalf of others. He has begun with, as we've already seen, a whole series of virtues and practices that are presupposed, and there's a kind of a little riddle, rather like what we've seen before in number 26.2. One who has piously destroyed within him the three principal passions has also destroyed the five too. And five principal passions, three principal passions, as we'll see, he's a little leery of trying to provide specific definitions of an order or a sequence among the passions, but he is willing to list the primary problematic ones, and they are the ones that are obviously opposed to the virtues, which he has already described. Discernment, he says, in number 26.3, is an undefiled conscience and a purity of feeling. And he continues on roughly in this way with a whole series of what amount to apophthegmata on the subject of perceiving the divine will within the self. Many of these are not what we would call specifically concerned with the task of discernment or discrimination between that which is good and evil, but are simply reminders to live out the life of virtue, which for him, as we've seen, is a prerequisite to making any kind of spiritual progress. But in numbers 26.17 and then in 26.19, he provides a list which is intended to be memorized and meditated upon. In number 26.17, an alphabet, that is an alphabetical listing, or a list of virtues according to the number of characters in the Greek alphabet, initially which are concerned with those who are new to the spiritual life, beginning with obedience, fasting, sackcloth or rough clothing, ashes, tears, confession, all of these things having to do with deep penitence, silence, humility, then vigil, acting against one's nature, being willing to stay up and pray, to keep courage, as in letter J or kappa in Greek. And you see that on the left we've given the letters according to the English alphabet, and then on the right according to the Greek alphabet. Toil, hard work, humiliation, and contrition. Letter P, forgetfulness of wrongs. Love of the brethren, a concern for those with whom one lives, gentleness or meekness, and then progressing up in the last ones to detachment, simplicity and voluntary abasement, a willingness to undertake that which is unnaturally unpleasant or difficult, and a willingness to be regarded as the least of all. And then he says a scheme for the advanced, number 2618, an evidence of progress, and he gives a specific list of virtues, is aorgasia, a capacity to be free from anger, and that's preceded by or presupposed by an absence of vainglory, a willingness to acknowledge one's relationship with and dependence on others, hope and silence. Then diakrisis, the subject of this whole step, is itself a kind of a monastic virtue as well, a memory of the judgment of compassion, that is to say that when we make distinctions or when we experience ourselves caught in things that can't be avoided, to recognize that even what may seem to be a judgment is in fact an act of compassion on God's part, and so forth, hospitality, moderation, and reproof. Then a second alphabet, and you can see that he's providing mnemonic devices, things intended specifically for commitment to memory and then later reflection, a second alphabet for those who are aiming, he says, at perfection, not merely beginners, but those who are making some progress. An unfettered heart, a heart that is not bound to particular things, a love that is growing in perfection. And if you move up, just noting a couple of these, detachment of mind, and then finally security of light and prayer and indwelling of Christ, an outpouring, he says, of divine illumination, in number Ada. And here I've given the Greek letters primarily, together with the sequence that corresponds more specifically to the onward progression of the English alphabet. The same individual who's making progress acquires, in addition to this indwelling, a longing for death, a longing for being with Christ. He uses rather strict and even negative language, a hatred of light, flight from the body, but more positively, an intercessor for the world. One who is capable of offering up the world in prayer, one who pleads with God for prayer, a fellow worshiper with the angels, and then finally, as one makes a lot of progress, what he calls an abyss of knowledge, a house of mysteries, and a guardian of that which is unspeakable, or a keeper of secrets is another way, or another possible way of translating this. A savior of others, a cooperator with God in the process of salvation, and this presupposes obviously both prayer and the offering of spiritual advice, and mastery of the body, banishment of sin, and then finally, apatheia, a capacity to be free of the storm of addictions and compulsions, and finally an imitator of the Lord. He disputes the Evagrian and later idea of a clear distinction or a clear distinction in progress within the vices. He talks about, and here's the relationship between the three and the five that he's already mentioned above here in 2639. He mentions which of the three chief sins are the father of the other five. And he says, by pleading ignorance, I learned from the fathers the following, that the mother of lust is gluttony, the mother of despondency, vainglory, sorrow, and anger are the offspring of those fundamental three, cupidity, sensuality, and ambition. And then finally, the mother of pride is vainglory. But other than this, rather general and deeply intertwined, one might be tempted to say slightly confused, gathering together of the virtues, he goes on to say in 2640 that despite the fact that people like the idea of describing orderings within the passions, and this is certainly a theme in Evagrius and a number of other spiritual authors who follow him, he says, and he claims to be citing one of the Desert Fathers, the irrational passions have no order or reason, but they have every sort of disorder and every sort of chaos. So he would require a constant attentiveness to the self to be aware of the unique sequence of passion or of vice within each unique individual. If we drop quite a ways down now to past number 2668, where he says that there are virtues that are above nature, chastity, aorgasia, or freedom from anger, humility, prayer, vigil, fasting, compunction. These are the particularly monastic virtues, those that are sought out in an ascetical context, and that introduces a context of what he calls expert discernment. And part of his expert discernment, we'll find if we drop quite a ways down to number 26, 152, we'll see that he says there that at the beginning of monastic life, some of the unclean demons instruct us in the interpretation of divine scriptures. He's very cautious about anyone who claims to be an authority on a biblical interpretation. And remember that this is a strong theme with Evagrius, that one progresses towards a capacity to understand the deeper meanings of the biblical text. One advances to the possibility of an allegorical interpretation. Well, he's rather, Climacus is a bit suspicious of those who claim to understand these allegorical interpretations. And he says, the demons instruct us in the interpretation of scripture. They are fond of behaving in this way in the case of the vainglorious who have been educated in secular studies, and then by deceiving them, they are led into heresy and blasphemy. And here, as we saw before, he calls this diabolical divinity, or rather devilry, causes disturbances and a confused and unholy joy. So the joy over discovering these deeper meanings, he would say, is evidence not of the divine, but of a demonic fascination with things that need to be reserved to much later when one has achieved a real level of spiritual progress. We would have to say that this concern that we've seen before with joy as not so much a sign of the angelic, but in Climacus as something that one should be suspicious of, this is much more carefully nuanced much later in the tradition with the idea of the distinction between consolations and desolations that one finds especially in the late medieval writings and the Carmelite, and then especially in the writings of St. Ignatius and the Jesuit tradition of the discernment of spirits. But it has its origins in these probing attempts to be aware of the limitations of even what is praised or recommended by other spiritual authors. And certainly Climacus is very critical of some of the material that we've seen recommended in folks like Evagrius and Cassian. The latter part of number 26, from 126-191 onwards, is a brief summary, a kind of series of brief apophthegmata that to some extent attempt to summarize the preceding material, and I advise you to go back and take a look at it as you have the opportunity, as you have the leisure. And then in number 27, he concerns himself here with hesychia, inward stillness or inward tranquility. And it has been suggested that many of the ideas that are suggested in Climacus provide the basis for the later development of the tradition of the Jesus Prayer. And certainly a kind of monologistic, of short phrase repetition of words or brief aspirations is already found, as we've seen, in Cassian and recommended in Evagrius. Well, it's also here in Climacus, and very specifically, as we'll see, linked to the breath in number 2762 and following, actually 2761. He says, "Let the remembrance of Jesus be present with each breath, and then you will know the value of solitude." Is one translation, but the word is actually hesychia, this inward stillness or solitude. So he is encouraging or recommending a prayer method that links prayer with the breathing. Now, this is not the full-blown Jesus Prayer as it will come to its finest flower in the Eastern tradition, coming from, to a very great extent, this particular abbey, having been taught and widely practiced here in the Abbey of St. Catherine's on Sinai. It comes to its full fruition in the 13th and 14th centuries, but here one can find traces of what will later become the Jesus Prayer tradition. He describes in 2760, solitude or hesychia, this inward stillness, is unceasing worship and waiting upon God. He is concerned for an interrelationship in 2778, between prayer and psalmody, but for him, the greater part of the night is to be given over to prayer. Prayer, presumably, which involves short phrases, short aspirations, as we'll see in the next chapter. Prayer that is simple, that is to say, that is brief, not necessarily imageless, not necessarily wordless, but at least brief and simple. And for him, that's the greater part of one's spiritual practice, and only a smaller portion, he says, is to be given over to the practice of psalmody. This is in 2777, or 2778, and the following one, which is actually misnumbered, it should be 2779, although it's listed as 77, that text involves a recommendation of reading, which is, of course, reading of the sacred scriptures. In 28, he moves on to the question of prayer, and 28.1 is a kind of a beautiful panegyric, a praise of prayer in a whole variety of forms. He's calling it by a whole variety of names: the mother and the daughter of tears, propitiation for sin, work of angels, food of the soul, wealth of monks, treasure of solitaries, mirror of progress. It's in prayer that one sees what one needs still to do, what one still has to offer to God, and how one still needs to change. And then in 28.5, let your prayer be completely simple. For both the parable publican and the prodigal son were reconciled to God by a single phrase. And it's clear here that he is interested in a brief phrase kind of prayer, and he uses the technical term for simplicity. He even employs the term monologistos. He is willing to describe the prayer as condensed or brief, or very much focusing down on an experience of prayer. And he says the attitude of prayer is one and the same for all, but there are many different kinds of prayer. So it's unlikely that there was a particular phrase or a single word or prayer formula that was employed, but that one was expected to have a variety of formulas. And he goes on, if we drop down now to number 2819, to talk about a beginning of prayer consisting in banishing the thoughts that come to us by single ejaculations. That means a kind of a casting out of prayer, but actually that's a translation here for the technical term monologistos, single or short phrase, single word prayer. And again, it doesn't just mean one word, but it does mean that one is intended to use a very brief kind of formula. And he distinguishes in 28:20 between the joy that occurs in solitude and the joy that comes from prayer when you are living together with people in community. And the one is elated, and the other, he says, is wholly filled with humility. There is an experience of being humbled in community that he believes is a very good thing. If we now move down to step 30, to the very last part of this book, even though we've seen a stronger ascetical emphasis, and as I mentioned, I haven't included some of the more extreme forms of his praise, particularly of a kind of asceticism that is very harsh as far as practices concerned with the body are concerned. Here in step 30, he moves up to a very beautiful rhapsodic vision of spiritual progress and of the incorporation of asceticism into one's life that allows a kind of using of imagery drawn from the Song of Songs that we've already seen in other authors and which we will see again. In 30.11, for example, he uses the example of the Beatitudes. He creates his own Beatitudes. We saw this in Evagrius' treatise on prayer. Here, blessed is he who has obtained such love and yearning for God as an enraptured lover has for his beloved. But at the same time, in the next one, he who fears the Lord as much as men under trial fear the judge. So it's a mixture of enraptured love and a tremendous sense of awe in the presence of God as well. He goes on, if we move on still further towards the end of this text, he describes in 30.35 that it's a kind of a ravishing of the soul which is a borrowing from the language of the Song of Songs. He goes on and says, still I will go forward and praise you. And the fairest of virtues, which is love, which is agape, even higher than apatheia, higher than simply being freed from the tumult of addictions and compulsions. He then tries to step back and see the beauty of the latter in the second and third and final paragraphs of this section. He describes this queen or king appears as if from heaven saying, unless, beloved, you renounce your gross flesh, you cannot know my beauty. May the latter teach you the spiritual combination of the virtues. So this text concludes with a very positive and notion involving the language of lover and beloved as a kind of a summit or a culmination of spiritual ascent. And again, as difficult as we may find this text, I think it is important to be aware of what it contains, certainly to know that it is a very important text, because, as I mentioned before, it is read by, actually it is read out in public each year in the context of daily refectory or chapter room readings in all Orthodox monasteries of monks and nuns, and so it still has a very powerful and compelling effect on Christians of the East.